Hello you, me here for a very laid back podcast, with me literally laid back in my chair, as opposed to, you know, in my little studio where I usually am, with my legs crossed and my arm on the arm of the chair, chatting to you like some night owl DJ, like Adrienne Barbeau in the 1980 film The Fog. This is Stevie Wayne, your nightlight, and KAB Antonio Bay is on the air. I do like The Fog, even though it's got its flaws. Like, number one, why the flip would a young woman like Jamie Lee Curtis want to have a romantic relationship with craggy old geezer Tom Atkins? I know he had a van or whatever it was he was driving around in, but every time I watch that film I think, really? But anyway, yes, back to this podcast. I wanted to get something out to you this week, patrons, but the next episode of Underwood and Flinch Underground is still being finalised and polished. As always, with the police-based episodes, it's been tricky because, you know, not being a policeman, I've got no police experience other than what I've seen, you know, in TV and movies and read in my research books. That, of course, and the OCU isn't real police either. So, you know, it's a marrying of real-world police stuff and complete fantasy. And though the draft of the next episode is finalised in its structure and content, I'm still getting the text right, and it's not ready yet. But, as I say, I still wanted to give you something from the underground world. But what? Well, I asked myself this question, and I had an idea. Since this whole Patreon thing, is a kind of inclusive production, with you, the reader or listener, actually coming along for the ride as far as the writing and production of this book goes, might it be interesting for you to look at some of the things that I write but don't actually include in the finished story? Now, some people are saying yes, some people are saying no. But anyway, now, one such bit, and I've often thought about podcasting this in some fashion, but never quite know how to do it. And so this kind of, you know, offers me that opportunity. But anyway, let's just talk about it. It's from episode 27, and David and Ronnie Bishop have just met for the first time and are in the pub opposite Holborn Station. This is just before David spots Damo and goes running into Holborn. Now, this, of course, is the area of the story that I've been, you know, reviewing and writing episodes from at the moment, and so I've gone back to this area. So, you know, it's uppermost in my mind. It's a first and a non-revised draft, because obviously it was scrapped, and it doesn't have an ending. You know, I stopped it before I ended it. But why then? Why did I stop it? Why did I cut it? Basically, I think, because I realised that this was a story in itself, and it was far too big a story for a secondary character in Underwood and Flinch Underground to be telling. It was making episode 27 too long. And practically all, if not all of it, was irrelevant to the action of episode 27, which needed to be tight and to the point, not going, you know, miles off topic. So, you know, having read it and, you know, just recorded it, it reminds me of the sort of thing you'd find in a detective story, you know, where the client comes in and engages the detective, tells him everything he knows, and then the rest of the story is the detective trying to find out what happened. But there you are, you see. But that, as the saying goes, is literally another story. And I did have a kind of, you know, a denouement for it, an ending for it that could have occurred later in Underground, but I was never sure whether I was going to use it. And now I'm, you know, 99% sure that I never will, because it's still basically just not necessary. But for all that, for all it's not being necessary, I did write what I wrote of it, and the backstory is still, whether used or not, Ronnie's backstory. So, here it is then, if you're interested. Let me just say, to be clear, that this is a cutscene. None of it matters. It's not going to impact on the action of Underground. I just share it here with you as a kind of a bonus. So, where are we? David and Ronnie have been talking about the London vampire. Ronnie has told David what he heard about the historic vampire, known only as the Lord, who killed the original Malleus group back in Victorian London, which, in case you don't know, was chronicled in the Underwood and Flinch story Disturbing the Devil. But that's another story. We're at a point now, then, where Ronnie has been telling David about how Coleridge and his partner beat him up on a towpath of the Regent's Canal in Camden in 1981, and how, strangely, they both had silver rings on the third fingers of their right hands. Oh, and before we begin, some word references for people not familiar with UK slang, at least old UK slang. Puff is cannabis. Billy Whiz is amphetamine sulfate, or speed. The Nick is a police station. The Plod is the police officers, presumably because police constables traditionally walk around a lot on the beat, and plod is a slang word for walking in a bored fashion. And lastly, to flash the ash is to socially offer your cigarettes to other people. So smokers will, or at least used to, say, I don't know, I haven't been in this situation for nearly 20 years, it's my flash, or it's your flash, depending on whose turn it is, to share their cigarettes. And so, without the usual theme tune, because this isn't an episode of Underwood and Flinch Underground, here is the cutscene from Underground, episode 27. David was trying to process what Ronnie had just told him. Coleridge, one of the ring-wearing thugs that had beaten Ronnie up in 1981, was now leading the hunt for the London vampire. So what? You think maybe this guy Coleridge might be some kind of modern-day member of the Malleus Society? Ronnie spread his hands and shrugged. I don't know. Could be just a coincidence. It was the early 80s. Men were wearing makeup, gender bending and all of that. Maybe him and his mate were just being fashionable. Or maybe, yeah, they were part of some secret society. Which seems the more unlikely to you? It is strange. Certainly an unlikely coincidence. What is it you were doing on the night they beat you up?
Following someone. Someone they were also following.
Who?
Bloke I suspected had a role in the missing person case I just mentioned.
Tell me about it, the case. What happened? Ronnie smiled.
What's it worth?
What?
How much are you willing to pay me for it?
Really? Said David. I thought we were working together on this.
We are, but you can put the emphasis on working. Right now, you're like any newspaper editor. You want a story, you got to pay for it.
David sighed and took out his wallet. He had three £20 notes. He took them out and showed them to Ronnie. This is all I've got. Ronnie took the notes and tucked them into the chest pocket of his jacket.
That'll do. So?
He leaned closer over the table and resumed his confidential tone.
Back in 1981, I was working for a weekly music paper called Sounds. Good times they were. Music wasn't shit like it is now. It was all going on. Ska, punk, new romantic, heavy metal. But me, I was into the emerging goth scene. Susie and the Banshees, Bauhaus, Sex Gang Children, Alien Sex Fiend, you know?
Wait, you were a goth? David squinted, trying to blur the image of this balding, bespectacled 50-something into a leather-clad young man with black-painted eyes and a black Mohican. Ronnie laughed.
Well, I used to dress up for the clubs a bit. Easier to pull the birds that way. Half of them wouldn't have looked at you twice if you come in wearing normal street clobber, and they definitely wouldn't have danced with you.
Right, said David, smiling. So what did you look like?
A knob, most likely. But at the time I blended in well enough. Anyway, there was one bird I used to see at a goth night they used to have down at Dingwall's. Isabel May.
His eyes moved away as he said her name.
God, there's a name I haven't said in a long while. Lovely Isabel May. Izzy. I was mad about her. Now, she was a goth, not a part-timer like me. She was 24/7. Raven black hair, rings, bangles. She rattled when she walked. She used to have so many bangles on. And her figure in some of those outfits she used to wear. He shook his head. All the blokes wanted her. She could take her pick, and she did too. I wasn't high on the list. Not being a full-timer was one of the things that went against me. And not having a ready supply of puff and Billy Whiz was another. But one thing I did have was me plus one on the guest list at any gig in town. Music journo, you know? So, sometimes I'd get lucky with her. Take her to a gig, get her in for free, and at the end of the night, she'd stay over at mine. Fuck me. He closed his eyes and touched a hand to his brow, shielding them. She was something, mate. If I'm honest, I loved her. I really did. But she wasn't into that. Regular boyfriend, being tied down and all that. Not with the likes of me, anyway. But then, he came along.
He took his hand from his face and a bitterness had come into his eyes.
Vincent, she said his name was. No surname, just Vincent. Right wanker he was. Handsome, and he knew it. Thick black hair. Dyed, of course. But so thick he could probably slosh gallons of bleeding dye on it and not give a toss if he lost half of it. Not like me. Well, see for yourself. I was always thin on top, so dyeing it was never a smart move. Not that it stopped me. I sometimes wonder whether that was the start of it falling out.
Yeah, anyway, said David impatiently, you were saying about this Vincent bloke.
Yeah, right. So, Izzy starts seeing him. She was mad about him. You could see it in her face, in her body language, whenever she was around him. I was jealous, of course. Sick with jealousy. But what can you do? She was a 10, he was a 10. I was a 5, at best. All I could do was avoid him. I decided to devote myself exclusively to the heavy metal scene, which pleased the editor no end because Sounds was big on metal at the time. I didn't see her for weeks. Then I ran into a mate of hers at a gig. She asked me if I'd seen Izzy before she left town. Of course, I'm stunned by this, and I say, what? Left town? When? And she says, last week. She and that Vincent packed up and moved up to Leeds. So I was gutted, you know? Leeds was the centre of the goth universe back then, so in a way it made sense. But why would she leave all her friends? And she had a lot of friends, believe me. So I went round to the squat where she'd been living and asked her housemates if they knew anything. They told me she'd basically just disappeared one night, left practically all her stuff, along with a note saying she didn't want any of it and was moving to Leeds.
Ronnie paused to take a drink of his pint. Did she say why she'd gone? Asked David.
No, but her housemate said it must have been Vincent's idea. Funny thing was, they told me Izzy had been knackered for about a week before she left. Weak, sickly, like she was coming down with something. She'd sleep all through the day and only rouse herself at night when he came round. They'd go into her room, and when they came out, she'd be her old self again. Now, maybe it was the restorative power of just being around that turd she was lovesick for, but I thought it was more likely he was chopping out some premium whiz for her. That would explain how come she was always so wasted on the next days. And how she'd have had the energy to move up to bleeding Yorkshire. But it didn't explain why she'd go. Leaving her stuff like that, leaving her mates.
Ronnie shook his head.
It just wasn't like her.
So what did you do?
What could I do? It's not like she was my bird or anything. Don't think I didn't think about going up there and looking for her. For a while I thought about nothing else. I'd dream about finding her living a shitty life, hating him and throwing her arms around me when I came to rescue her. But what were the chances of that? More likely she was having a great time. I'd turn up at her door and a pair of them would just laugh at me and tell me to fuck off. So, I did what anyone else would have done in my position. I moved on, tried to forget about her. Look at the bright side, I thought. At least I can go back to my old haunts again without having to worry about seeing her and him now. And so I did. A couple of weeks went by, and I was starting to feel better, you know? Realising there was other birds in the world besides Isabel Bleeding May. But then one night, I was at a UK decay gig, and I saw him. Vincent. He was watching the band, but he wasn't with Izzy. He was with some other bird. Now, the sensible part of me wanted to leave it. None of my business, right? But I'd had a few pints and I was so surprised to see him that before I knew it, I was tapping him on the shoulder. He turns around and I say, or shout, since the band was playing at the time, "All right, mate, where's Izzy? Heard you two have moved up to Leeds." He shakes his head and says he's heard the same thing about her moving, only without him. Said she dumped him the night before she left, and that was the last he's seen of her. Big argument, he reckoned. We couldn't really hear each other, but there wasn't really that much to say. She dumped him and run off to Leeds. That was all there was to it. But it didn't sit well with me, you know. So the next day I went round to the squat to see if any of them knew where Izzy's parents lived. They didn't, but while they'd either sold her stuff off or claimed it for themselves as she suggested they do in her note, they still had some of her personal stuff kept aside just in case she came back, including her address book. She'd had it since before she moved out of the family home, and she'd written her own address in the front of the book in the "This Book Belongs To" bit, along with a phone number. I rang it and spoke to the dad. And guess what?
He didn't know where she was. Ronnie nodded.
They didn't even know she'd moved.
Weren't they in touch with her?
She lived in a squat, Dave. No phone, and none of your mobile phones then either. Izzy used to use a call box whenever she rang them or anyone else. The parents lived in Norwich, so not exactly round the corner.
So what happened?
Well, after I told them what had happened and how no one knew where she was, they called the police to report a missing person. I went into Camden Nick to tell them what I knew, and the police interviewed their housemates and all. For a while after that, I'd give the parents a ring from time to time because they were the only ones the cops were giving updates to. Not that there were any updates. Posters went up in police stations in London and Leeds, but that was about it. It was frustrating. You're so bloody helpless in that situation. Like there's nothing you can really do but wait for... For what? For nothing to keep on happening. But then I realised there was something I could do. I could write a story on it and get it into one of the nationals. Of course, there was nothing unique in the situation. Stuff like that goes on every day. But I reckoned if I could find an angle, make it intriguing enough, then I could shift it. Maybe even get it onto Police 5.
Police 5? David had never heard the phrase.
It was a TV show, a call for witnesses sort of thing. Were you on such and such a street at 10 p.m. on Thursday night? If so, ring your local Nick. Stuff like that. Used to get a big response. So I went back to Camden Nick, but this time to ask the questions, only to be told the case had been passed on to Falconbridge.
The same place that's currently investigating the London vampire murders?
Well, yeah, supposedly. But back then it was actually open for business. A proper little cop shop it was. So I went down there and asked to speak to the bloke who was in charge of the case. And out comes the then Detective Constable Coleridge. Unlike the plod up at Camden, he was very interested in what I had to say, especially about Vincent. He said they already had his name and they were looking into him. I asked him if he was a suspect, but he says he can't say, only that they're pursuing their inquiries.
Ronnie raised his fingers and made quotation marks in the air.
But then he starts asking me about my movements at the time as he went missing, like he thinks I might have something to do with it. Questioned me for about an hour or so, he did. So much for me asking the questions. But still, I was happy to talk with him because I had nothing to hide, and I can see they were taking it seriously.
Ronnie drained his glass and nodded to the window.
Listen, I need a fag. You want to come or stay here?
No, I'll come with you, said David. I could use a fag myself.
Good, said Ronnie, rising. You can flash the ash. I'm running low.
Actually, I was hoping I could catch one off you. I haven't got any.
Typical, said Ronnie, shaking his head in disgust. You know, you're doing better out of this deal than I am. Come on.
Outside. So, you were saying, said David through a stream of exhaled smoke. Coleridge was questioning you about Izzy.
Yeah, I told him everything I knew. Like I said, I had nothing to hide. He writes it all down in his notebook and tells me they'll be in touch if they need to see me again. I tried to get some answers out of him for my story, but he wouldn't give me shit. Said they didn't have anything as yet, but would make a public statement when the time came. Waste of time, right? So I did what I arguably should have done in the first place. I looked in the gig listings to see what goth acts were playing up in Leeds over the next few nights. If Isabel had gone up there for the scene, then she'd most likely be at the gigs, right? So, I saw there was a show by a then obscure little outfit called the Sisters of Mercy. I'd heard their single and I knew there was a buzz about them, so I had a word with my editor and convinced him to comp me a train ticket so I could go up and do a review of the gig and interview the band afterwards. He grinned. A Ronnie Bishop coup, that was. First national music paper to do a big piece on them. But anyway, while that part of the job went well, nothing else did. Isabel didn't show up. I showed the missing person poster of her around, but no one, neither punters nor staff, recognised her. I left them with a copy of it and asked them to call me if she came in, but they never did. And that's as far as it goes. There is no more. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen. The music there generously provided by your fellow Patreon sect member, Andrew Rothman. At least as far as I wrote it. Do you see what I mean about how it was just getting too big, and certainly too big for the action of episode 27? If I told all that, you'd have forgotten why David was even talking to Ronnie in the first place. And also, you know, I have to ask myself, would Ronnie have shared all that with a stranger? Maybe, but I didn't think so, much as I would have liked him to. And so, it's cut. What happened next is basically Ronnie keeps looking into the story and his suspicions of Vincent deepen. And one night he follows him from a gig along the Regent's Canal towpath in Camden, only to be told to stop and back off by Coleridge and his partner, who are also surveilling him. Ronnie tells them no, and so, because this is making them lose their quarry, the policemen beat Ronnie into a condition where he can't follow. They then continued after Vincent. After that, Ronnie did back off, and he and Coleridge have been on unfriendly terms ever since. Isabel May was never found or heard of again. So, was Vincent a vampire? No one ever knew. But between you and me, yes, he was. Ah, you see, such a big story. A novel in itself, you might say. Too big for Underwood and Flinch Underground, but just big enough in this contracted version for this little podcast. And I hope you enjoyed it. But now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to go. For the 20-year-old Jamie Lee Curtis has just formed a sudden and illogical attraction to me simply because I've got a car and she's into old geezers. So we're going to drive off down to Rosslare Harbour to battle vengeful ghost zombies, as you do. So, from me for now, this is Stevie Wayne, your nightlight, and KB Antonio Bay is going off air. And so, until the next time, farewell.
MikeBennettAuthor.com